The first Sunday after Labor Day is often the time local churches begin their program year. And so it makes sense that we would begin this new program year with a reading from the Gospel of Mark. For the Gospel of Mark was the first of the four Gospels written. Now, most folks think that when you begin to tell a story, like the Jesus story, that you would begin with a version that casts the faith in the best light possible in order to attract the most followers possible, right? You'd think that you'd begin by making claims like, come follow Jesus, and you'll instantly lose 10 pounds. Or you'll finally get that flashy convertible you've had your eyes on for years. Or that you would receive that mind-boggling promotion at work. You might think that that's a good way to start the story, but you'd be wrong in this case. For the Gospel of Mark makes it clear, right out of the gates, that if you end up following this Jesus, he's going to turn your world upside down. Today's story from the 7th chapter of Mark is a great example of that. You see, for the first 6.5 chapters of Mark's Gospel, Jesus is humming right along with a pretty clear focus in his life and ministry. He spent most of his days reaching out to his sisters and brothers of the faith, who, like him, had been raised Jewish. Through his words and his deeds, he spent his time trying to expand their notion of what following God was all about. But then, something happened in the 7th chapter of Mark that changed not only Jesus' audience, but seems to have changed something within Jesus himself. And that something was an encounter with someone. That someone wasn't someone we'd expect, a rich, well-educated Jewish man. No, in today's story, that someone was a Greek, Gentile, unaccompanied, and get this, woman. So listen to this shocking encounter that many biblical scholars say changed Jesus, followed by a second healing story. And then let's come back together and see how the stories might change our own perceptions about life and about faith. Mark chapter 7, verses 27 through 34, as read from the Message. From there, Jesus set out for the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house there where he didn't think he would be found, but he couldn't escape notice. He was barely inside when a woman who had a disturbed daughter heard where he was. She came and knelt at his feet, begging for help. The woman was Greek, Syrophoenician by birth. She asked him to cure her daughter. He said, "Stand in line and take your turn. The children get fed first. If there's any left over, the dogs get it." She said, "Of course, Master, but don't dogs under the table get scraps dropped by the children?" Jesus was impressed. "You're right. On your way. Your daughter is no longer disturbed. The demonic affliction is gone." She went home and found her daughter relaxed on the bed, the torment gone for good. Then Jesus left the region of Tyre and went through Sidon, back to Galilee Lake, and over to the district of the 10 towns. Some people brought a man who could neither hear nor speak and asked Jesus to lay a healing hand on him. He took the man off by himself, put his fingers in the man's ears, and some spit on the man's tongue. Then Jesus looked up in prayer, groaned mightily, and commanded, "Ephatha, open up." And it happened. The man's hearing was clear and his speech plain, just like that. Jesus urged them to keep it quiet, but they talked it up all the more, beside themselves with excitement. "He's done it all, and done it well. He gives hearing to the deaf and speech to the speechless." Thus ends the reading. Before I read this morning's stories to you, I talked about a few things that made this passage different than you might expect. And when I laid those things out for you, I focused exclusively on the the social location of the person with whom Jesus had contact. Things like gender, race, and social status. But there is another thing that makes this particular story, the first of the two, remarkable as well. For you see, in many of the healing stories contained in the Gospels, once Jesus has effected the healing, he says something to the person along the lines of, "Your faith has made you well." But Jesus didn't use those words. Once the woman's pleas won him over and he decided to participate in the healing of the woman's daughter. Now this time he said something different. In the message, we were told that Jesus said simply, "You're right." In the Common English Bible, we're told that he said, "Good answer." And in the King James Version, we're told he said, "For saying this, go thy way." All of those interpretations of Jesus' answer have led many to conclude that it wasn't the woman's logos, or reasoning that caused her to be healed, not her pistis, or faith. Well, if that's what you think, that it was her reasoning and not her faith that got her healed, Matthew Skinner, professor of New Testament at Luther Seminary, writes that you'd be wrong. For if you look closer at the elements of the story, Skinner writes, it's full of examples where the woman's faith carried her along. Think, he says, about the persistence the woman showed in standing up to Jesus himself with the repeated pleas. Think about her understanding of Jesus' power, as represented by her belief that if Jesus offered even a crumb, that would be enough to effect the healing of her daughter. And think about the end of the story itself, when her faith in Jesus' words allowed her to return home without first having others verify the healing. At every turn in the story, the woman's faith, not just her reasoning, proved to be a model for us and for Jesus himself. Well, how did this woman, who was not raised around the temple or even in the nation of Israel itself, get such a profound faith, you might wonder? She sure didn't get it from teachers or books. Well, if that's what you're thinking, you'd be right. For she didn't get that faith from books or teachers. Instead, she got her faith from the place that you would least expect, a place that Matthew Skinner called painfully experienced need. Painfully experienced need. And therein, my friends, lies one of the most powerful dimensions of today's story. That story tells us that the muscles of our faith aren't typically developed best during the good times. No, they grow best and strongest during the bad. In reflecting on that, the woman's persistence, Matthew Skinner wrote these words. Who says that things like desperation and tenacity aren't the same thing as faith when that description and tenacity are brought to Jesus? In the Gospel of Mark, faith is hardly about getting Jesus' name or title right, about nailing the right confession or articulating the proper doctrine. It's about clinging to Jesus, Skinner said, and expecting him to heal, to restore, and to save. It's about demanding he do what he said he came to do. So, friends, what does that faithful tenacity of the woman look like today? And how can we use the very worst of times to grow the very strongest faith? One of the best examples of that I can think of came from the story of a man by the name of William Griffith Wilson. William Griffith Wilson was born in East Dorset, Vermont, 4 days after Thanksgiving in the year 1895. He had an older sister, Dorothy, and two loving parents, Gilman and Emily. His idyllic childhood was upended when his father, Gilman, decided to divorce his mother and move far away to British Columbia. His mother responded in kind by moving to Boston, becoming one of the first women to graduate from Harvard, where she studied osteopathic medicine. William was left then to be raised by his grandparents. And his loving grandparents did the best they could to restore a sense of stability to little William and his sister Dorothy's lives. William succeeded socially and academically for a while, but continued to experience problems. A girl that he had fallen head over heels in love with in high school died suddenly. And the ensuing depression that event triggered paralyzed William, so much so that he was unable to finish high school. A few years later, he met another wonderful woman, Lois, who was the daughter of a prominent physician. He then went into the military, got his education finished, and became a commissioned second lieutenant in the service. Following his military service in World War I, William decided to get a little bit more education. So he began studying the fields of economics and law. And at this point, everything looked great for William, right? It would seem that he had nothing in common with the Syrophoenician woman in this morning's story. Don't be too sure. For you see, as William struggled with the all-consuming pain of his parents' divorce, the death of his first love, and his bouts of chronic depression, William developed a coping mechanism for dealing with the pain. Alcohol. Alcohol became his constant friend and ally. And that alcohol began to take a toll. William was unable to finish the exams for his law degree due to the effects of his drinking. And later, when he tried to put his economics training to use by going to work for a brokerage firm, he eventually lost that job too, due to his drinking. His and Lois' lives were so upended by the effects of alcohol that they eventually had to move back in with Lois's parents. And no matter what he tried, his life seemed to get worse and worse and worse until he reached a point of desperation that was every bit as bad as the Syrophoenician's woman's desperation. It wasn't until William bumped into an old friend one day by the name of Ebby. Ebby was a man that William knew to have a serious problem with alcohol. But this time when they bumped into each other, he discovered that Ebby had completely stopped drinking. How, he asked. And Ebby began to share his experience. William carried that conversation and those insights with him, until a few months later when he bumped into another gentleman, a doctor by the name of Robert H. Smith. And over the course of weeks after their meeting, a movement, one intended to reach those in the desperate throes of alcoholism, was born, something that today we know as Alcoholics Anonymous. Those who have experienced the program and its principles, or its 12 steps that William and Dr. Bob put down in a book known as The Big Book, those folks know that the program is based upon a difficult truth. And that truth is this, that many of us come to the place where we truly seek healing and hope, not during the good times, but the bad, the worst. And until we reach that point of desperation, when we hit what they call the bottom, until we hit our bottom, we will continue to buy into the fallacy that we can do it all alone. That is why William and Dr. Bob's very first step of the 12 says simply this: we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Until that admission is made, healing, strength, and hope will be elusive. And in closing, let me say this. That, my friends, is the good news that I have to share with you through the experience, the strength, and the hope, both of the Syrophoenician woman and the story of William Griffith Wilson. And that good news is this. Friends, we don't have to fear the bad times in our lives. And we don't have to worry that those bad times will shake our faith. Instead, we can see those terrible times for what they really are. Valuable opportunities that can drive us from the arms of fear, despair, and doubt into the arms of another. Jesus. For it is through his embrace that we can truly know healing, hope, and peace like never before. May it be so. Amen.